Great, so why don't we begin? I'm Trip Gulick from New York. This is an opportunity just for us to talk, really, and to talk about what the ongoing issues are with PEP and PrEP. I know that people are from all over the country. Like medical school, everyone likes to sit in the back row, but feel free to sit wherever you like, because we have seats. So I didn't prepare stuff because I just thought that we could get the ball rolling and talk about it. How many people in the room are prescribing PrEP right now? Raise your hand. How many people aren't prescribing PrEP? Okay, so this is, thank you for volunteering. So like half the people said yes, one person said no. What are the other people doing? Giving it away. No. So what are the other people doing if you're not prescribing it?
Work at a only HIV-positive clinic, so can't prescribe.
So this is an interesting issue, right? I don't know if everybody heard. She said, we work out of an HIV-positive clinic, so we're not really seeing the people who need PrEP. I'm changing your words a little, but that's what she said. So is that what the other people were? The reason you didn't raise your hand is because you don't have the opportunity to do it. So yeah.
I also have that experience. I work at one HIV-only QHC, and then I work at an unrelated QHC just doing primary care. And so I've prescribed PrEP a few times at the non-HIV clinic, which is completely open to do any testing or any people. And one thing I realized really quickly is Truvada is a whole different drug when you're prescribing it that way. And I still had a few adult-age patients refer to me, and I'm still really getting the hang of it in terms of doing it right.
Interesting.
Getting the hang of the test and everything like that.
Did everybody hear all that? So you bring up some really good issues. So he works mostly in an HIV-positive clinic, like many of us in the room, does a session in a non-HIV-infected clinic, and he said that the question of PrEP comes up, as it does with all of us, but did he have the support in the clinic really to do what he needed to do in terms of the testing, for instance? Does everybody have access to the fourth generation ELISA at this point? Really, everybody. Does anyone not? Raise your hand if you don't. You know, my own hospital just converted to it about 3-4 months ago. It took them forever. Is that a requirement of Ryan White that you have it?
No.
It's just state of the art, right? So everybody's got it now. So that's part of it. But do you have all the algorithms in place to yeah, that's what this was done. Okay. There, done.
I don't know how they're going to hear you guys, because that's what I thought was the more important thing. But to have the whole thing in place about how you do the testing and then how you see people, particularly for the STD testing, right, and then how you do the safety testing. Are some places, do you have that whole system up and running and doing well? Mm-hmm. It is catching on, I would say. But, yeah, that's a real problem. I mean, for a while we were saying we know these drugs the best, the HIV providers, yet we're trying to reach people that we didn't traditionally reach, right, in our clinics. Everyone's shaking their head, so I guess we all feel this way. So we're looking to our colleagues in internal medicine to get comfortable with this, comfortable enough to prescribe. Has anyone had a good story about that, talking to your colleagues about it? Do you all provide support to them? Yeah, I get emails and calls all the time. What about this? You know, this person has low creatinine clearance. What are their options for PrEP? That kind of thing. Yes, everyone's saying yes. So what challenges are you facing with PrEP right now? So you brought up
two huge issues,
right?
Yes,
no, and that was good.
But that's
two big things. We probably should talk about both of them, right? One was the issue of serodiscordant couples, where just the case that Mike had, right? So the negative partner's been negative forever, but the positive partner is coming in to talk to you about PrEP. Or, sorry, I reverse that. Positive partner is suppressed on meds for a long time. The negative partner is coming in because they've heard about PrEP or they want PrEP or something's changing in their lives, as we hinted at, and they want PrEP. And then the other issue you brought up was, can we really do the every 3-month follow-up visits? Are people doing that?
Yes.
Yeah? Well, routinely?
I made some adjustments with some of the young men that come for PrEP, that they can come for the, they don't necessarily have to see me at one of those 3-month intervals, but they can come get their labs.
Okay.
And if there's any problems, they can talk to the nurse, or I don't have to deal with the case manager, but they can talk to the nurse, or they can let me know if they have a problem. But coming back just for the labs and not necessarily seeing me every 3 months seems to be working well.
So are other people doing that too, to say you don't need a doctor visit necessarily every 3 months? You can get the blood test done. And then, you know, some innovative clinics.
STI screens as well.
So innovative clinics are actually allowing people to self-swab?
We do.
Oh, that's cool.
We started from the beginning. It took a minute to get it to work right. But, my trans patients and my young men who have sex with men, my young gay men, they all self-swab. We have a thing in the bathroom
to tell you what to do.
To them what to do.
And you're doing all three sites?
All three sites.
Okay.
We do the urine, of course, they do. When
that one's the easy one, right?
Easy. But actually, my phlebotomist volunteered to do the pharyngeal swab when she's getting the blood work.
Okay.
So she's sort of in charge of all that. And we have 100% acceptance to self-swabbing. So we
Fantastic.
Don't get anybody denying that swab.
Wow. That's great news. CDC recommends every 6 months. But has everybody seen the data that came out of San Francisco and New York to show that every 3-month screening actually picks up a lot more STDs?
Yes.
Are you doing it every 3 or every 6?
Every 3.
Every 3? Is everybody doing every 3? Wow. Hello.
The biggest problem is getting the right people. And in our area, a lot of the high-risk kids haven't heard of PrEP.
Right.
And we just have our HIV-positive patients, and we ask them, the ones who gave a history of being infected recently, they've never heard of PrEP. We had them bring in their friends who were HIV negative. They hadn't heard of PrEP. So one of the big problems we have is trying to reach the group that needs to be reached.
Yeah, this is a national problem. Everybody's aware of this. So if you look at who's getting PrEP right now, it's mostly white people and mostly older people. And where are the new infections in HIV? It's mostly people of color and mostly younger gay men. That's the population that should be targeted. So one of the challenges to all of us is, how do you reach young gay men of color who don't access the healthcare system routinely anyway? Right? How do you get them? Because that's the population most in need. Yeah. Social media, people are saying.
That we work with is the transgender women. And many of the ones we had were not, even though they saw the risk, weren't ready to take them.
Really? Why? Did everybody hear that? Transgender women, big, big population to target for new HIV infection, right? Very high risk.
Uh-huh. And also fear of the whole health system.
Right, the lack of trust. And what you're getting me to take a pill? Kristen.
Retention in care for PrEP is similar to retention in care for HIV. There are a lot of challenges to keeping people engaged, keeping people going. In my limited experience, it works best if it's in the context of other things that matter. So if I'm just focusing on your risk of getting HIV and your need for a pill, they're not so interested. If it becomes more about them, other services that they might need, other social services like housing, mental health, just somebody who's willing to have a conversation with them about their sexual health, relationships, you build it into that fabric, I think it's more likely to keep going.
To put it into the context of a much bigger thing.
I've seen almost the opposite, actually. So I actually have a group of cohort I take care of, mostly I think of almost all people under the age of 25, and most of my patients on PrEP are young MSM.
Where do you work?
I'm in Long Island, actually, right around the corner from you.
Oh, okay. Yay.
So it's interesting because there's a huge difference in education and resources within New York City, within the five boroughs, the things the New York City Health Department is putting together, the resources and the knowledge of providers about PrEP within the five boroughs, and especially in Manhattan, compared to what's happening just really 25 minutes away in Long Island, which is just next to the corner. I think this is something that we're seeing for people that are not working in the urban core, that are more in suburbia, where we still have a very high-risk population that's there. A lot of individuals were being very successful working with LGBT organizations, being able to create partnerships to bring people in that are interested, especially youth. But again, the individuals that are we're accessing through that are largely more Caucasian than non-Caucasian. I don't think that we're seeing the cohort. But I'm finding that the groups of patients that I'm having a lot of success with PrEP on are those that really want to come and see the doctor and have not been able to engage with healthcare in Long Island with someone who they felt like was addressing their medical needs. They were just going to urgent care centers, pop-in clinics. They didn't have a relationship with a provider. And the ability to create that relationship around three-month visits with an open discussion of sexuality has been something that has been the driving force that has been able to help them attach to coming back down.
Yeah, this is a big thing, I think, that's going on right now. One interesting thing about PrEP was that there was no advocate for PrEP for a long time, right? It's approved by the FDA in 2012, but who was advocating for PrEP? It wasn't the drug company, right? So we can say it. Gilead makes Truvada, but they were not advertising. They had no marketing, no nothing with it. So then people said, well, it should be the advocacy community, patient advocates. But patient advocates traditionally have been HIV infected, right, and advocating for that. Then they said, well, it's the doctors. Yeah, right. We don't advocate for things so much. And the health departments across the country were really not engaged in this particular issue. And so who was left? Nobody. So there's a couple seats, by the way, if you want to. You're comfortable. I'm staying away from you. So that changed over time. So is everybody aware of this? So now there have been patient communities coming forward, say we want to protect ourselves. That's nice. And as well as Gilead has ads now. Have you seen them? Mm-hmm. So they do have ads now. Okay. And then most importantly, I think, were our departments of public health. And some really led the way. New York has been incredible what they've done. You can't ride a subway or bus without seeing a PrEP ad now. It's really incredible. So people, it's out there.
We're kind of a different. We're from Wyoming.
Wyoming!
Yeah, so it's total rural.
We're so glad you're here.
Right, because a total different perspective is getting our physicians on board.
Yeah, the physicians are...
were real, real resistant to it. Once again, it's like any kind of resistance patterns, things like that. Like they were, and we're set up a little bit different. So we're the only ID office in the whole state. So we travel everywhere and service everyone.
Wow.
But we're not connected with public health there across town. So it's like public health was on board, the ID office wasn't. So
interesting.
We have kind of a, we're still kind of in conflict. Like the old doc of the practice is like, no, the new, like, okay, let's do it. So it's like been.
So you're winning over the younger physicians, but there's distrust in the older physicians.
Yeah.
Does that sound familiar at all? Oh, wow.
It's really frustrating.
Pittsburgh?
Yeah, I know, it's weird. You think they would, but they don't. So you can, they have, one of the other clinics in town will advertise just saying, like, PrEP or...
without saying what it is.
You can't say the drug, and you can't say what it's for.
Wow, anyone else have that issue? Pittsburgh?
Yeah. I'm in the rural south.
Where are you? Which state?
North Carolina.
Okay.
I'm in rural North Carolina, and...
no ads?
No. That's not going to happen.
I'm from Mississippi, rural Mississippi. We've just gotten into, in our clinics, into the HIV market. This is our first national meeting. So we're getting acquainted with all the terminologies and all the things available, but that's not something that we're just not getting our HIV positive patients today to come in, to really come in and be suppressed. And so...
That's a whole nother kettle of
so
fish.
Let's not talk about partners who are negative, who wants to do other things. So this is something that really does not get the point of.
Interesting.
I was wondering, in the beginning, there was some stigma against PrEP. I don't know where we are now.
It's
very
still
much
is.
So.
It still is.
It's for several reasons, right? One is... have you seen these T-shirts that say Truvada whore on it? So there was, you know, why do you need this medication? What are you doing that you're having so much sex that you need to take this pill? There's that kind of line of thinking. And then there's the whole issue of just, I'm going to say, being caught with HIV meds. Does that, you know, it's in your medicine cabinet. Oh, are you HIV infected? So both those things, I think.
I think that's all over the map. Because, for example, in Boston, our patients come in and tell us that they have to go on PrEP because, you know, they use app-based technologies for social networking and finding people to have sex with. And unless they state that they're on PrEP, they actually won't be able to hook up with someone. So
wow.
It really is kind of all over.
It's sort of reverse stigma. If you're not protecting yourself, don't come over. That kind of thing. Well, I'm taking different people.
Yeah, one of the things that we ran into at one of the state meetings a while back here in Texas is that they were showing about how STD rates went up right when PrEP was picked up. And so the same thing, you know, in the 70s, with you give those girls birth control pills, and they're going to have a lot more sex. But then people throw that up there. So this is a
big issue I wanted to focus on too. Did everybody hear it's well, PrEP is going to make STD rates go up, and then they show curves. If you look closely at those curves, it was going up before PrEP was approved. That there were increases in the big three, right? Syphilis, gonorrhea, and chlamydia. Yeah.
I have a different type of question. What diagnosis?
It's exposure to HIV is one of the more common ones. High risk.
Did you memorize that ICD-10 code?
Z72.52.
Yeah. Z72.52. And which one is that, exposure or high risk?
High risk homosexual behavior. So there's homosexual and
heterosexual. So there's a lot of Z72.
There's a Z72.51, Z72.52.
Z72.5. So everybody write that down if you don't already know it. So it's perfect. Wow, ICD-10. Go. they're so specific, right? My favorite ICD-10 code was like hit by an asteroid. Have you seen some of those? Nothing to do with PrEP and PEP, but hilarious. Hilarious stuff.
I want to make a comment. I'm from Georgia, and we didn't expand Medicaid, so, you know, we're... anyway, so we have some of the insurance companies, like patients who are on PrEP, that they insist that patient gets that test within, you know, 3 months or whatever, and they will not refill their medication. So we've had a couple people who converted because during that...
They were between PrEP prescriptions because of the requirements.
Yes.
That's a tough one.
That's a drawback.
I wanted to go back to the STD question. What's the perception in the room with PrEP? Are STDs going up?
Yes.
Yeah. Now, some people are saying some... So, I'm an eternal optimist, if you know me. And I'm wondering, if we keep doing this and keep testing everybody every 3 months, will we wipe out these STDs? Won't we see a turnabout and things will go down because we're reaching the people who are potentially at highest risk?
We are, though. I my patients are really good and honest with me, I think, for the most part.
Yeah.
And when I tell them I'm giving them PrEP, then I say, well, so now are you going to use a condom? Most of them look at me and go, that's why I'm here for PrEP, so I don't have to. And
interesting.
So, you know, their feeling is I can get a shot for this. I can take, you know, this full of pill and get a shot for this. And so
the Kaiser Permanente, everyone knows that data that was published, the big Kaiser Permanente with hundreds and hundreds of PrEP prescriptions. They followed the men over time, San Francisco area. 50% had an STD, but how many had HIV?
Zero.
The big zero.
And that's why you prescribe PrEP, is to decrease HIV and to not decrease STD.
Right. Yes?
I think the question that you asked is a good question, and I think to answer that question, it really depends on where you're standing in, what part of the country you're standing in. Because if you're in the metropolitan area, you got a lot of providers, a lot of people, a lot of education surrounding sexually transmitted diseases, HIV. But when you're in the boondocks, really small towns, you have very few providers,
yeah,
even less infectious disease people and even less people who are interested in taking care of people with HIV disease. And you got a huge population of people who really don't buy into the fact that you're supposed to protect yourself against sexually transmitted diseases. Gonorrhea, chlamydia, doesn't matter. HIV way up on the spectrum and very far from their mind. So in those areas, I think the incidence of sexually transmitted diseases is still rising. Mm-hmm. And the diagnosis of HIV disease and AIDS is still going up. And it does not matter which particular section you're looking at. The numbers are going up in all the sections.
You know, the numbers would back you up on that. Joe Aaron reviewed a little bit of the epidemiologic data, and you saw the line is just slightly going down. But if you take it state by state, it's radically different. Some are going up, some are going down. It is quite different where you live. And where are you from, by the way?
Clarksville, Mississippi.
Okay. Same place. Yeah.
Hi, I work in the Bronx, so I'm in New York City.
Yay, well. New Yorker.
And so I do think that the advertising is great, but I also think that one of the challenges I've had is that I work with women who participate in transactional sex, and they've had a hard time. They go to their primary care providers. I deal with them on a volunteer basis, but they go to their PCPs asking for PrEP, and they don't necessarily disclose that they, you know, participate in transactional sex. And so their providers are telling them no, they don't need it, it's not necessary.
They're telling them they're low risk.
They're low risk because they're women. And if they ask for it, then it warrants a conversation as to where is that question coming from.
You are so right about that.
So it's been a challenge working with that patient population because I feel like even in New York City, they're definitely being undertreated.
Sex workers would be a primary population that would benefit, right, from PrEP. We all agree with that.
Any new agency in the pipeline, like for PrEP?
Yeah. So lots of stuff going on. The first thing to say is, anyone using TAF for PrEP?
No. Okay. I'm trying to, because I haven't heard a single reason why we wouldn't expect that that is going to do at least as well and be safer.
So they,
I've heard, I'm afraid, it's off-label, I don't want to be the first, all that stuff. But
the key word is expect. Here's the amount of data to show it works. Nothing. The worry is that, remember the good reason why we use TAF, right? It concentrates in the lymphoid cells, not in the end organs. We honestly don't know what it does, really.
Everything has been tested, though. It's TEF. It's been at least as good, if not better.
But this is a little bit different, right?
I've got a boxer that's 100 and lost none, and he's fighting again.
But, right, why does PrEP even work? Okay, we don't really know, but we think that having an antiviral in the right place at the right time will prevent the infection. But we don't actually know where the antiviral should be. Is it in the lumen, you know, or is it in the subcutaneous, just the mucosa, or is it deeper than that, or is it in the lymph nodes? We don't know.
Or all of the above.
Do you need it everywhere? So I'm a little skeptical about TAF. We just don't know. Now, the studies are fully enrolled. Everybody's aware of that, right? Head-to-head, huge studies, thousands of patients.
Looking good so far.
Well, we haven't heard anything. So you sound like an optimist like me. So they haven't been stopped.
I thought there was one study that didn't show it was as well.
Yeah, I can think that there was a study.
There was
a study, but Angela Kachuba's group, where they showed TAF penetration to cervical vaginal tissues and to rectal tissues was extremely poor and not thought to be protective.
I'm talking about clinical studies, though. I've got a lot of old patients coming in, and they are walking that tightrope. And I know it's approved for a GFR down to 30, but I am very scared, to 50, but I am afraid to give it to someone like that.
So this is a real issue, but and you quoted some great data. It's pharmacokinetic data. It's tissue data. All I would say to everybody in the room is we shouldn't use it routinely because we just don't know if it works or not, and there may be reasons why it doesn't. The difference in men and women is also important, right? Everyone realizes that TDF, tenofovir, gets into rectal mucosa 100-fold higher levels than in the female genital tract. So it may not work as well for women. I mean, we have good clinical studies to show, okay, in Africa, heterosexuals, it looked just as good. So I'm suggesting to most people, really, you gotta be careful and really don't routinely use TAF for PrEP because there just is no data. If you had someone with a low GFR and you had no choices and you were really worried about them and someone pressed you to the wall, you know, maybe it's better than nothing, but we just don't have the data.
I
Yeah. Ooh, I provoked some people. Good. I'm a provocateur.
I haven't been in that situation, but I'm actually anticipating in case I'm in that situation where I have a guy who's high risk, but has a GFR, and I know I don't like to use that because we have zero data, as you said. Would you use a tenofovir dose adjusted regimen the way we do on, you know, renal disease?
You could use it every other day, for sure. That would be a way to do it.
I'd be afraid that's going to finish.
It could.
What would your plan be?
It could.
Would you use like dolutegravir or something like that?
Nothing else has been proven, right? Everyone's aware of that. No other meds have been proven for PrEP. So probably.
Ravaroc was looked at some point, right?
Thank you. That was my study. And you didn't like Ravaroc, you said. It was a safety study, so we don't know if it actually works or not. And no one was enthusiastic about doing the big study to show that it worked, the big phase 3 study, because people have kind of moved on and said, if we're going to make a big improvement over one pill once a day, we got to go to injectables. And so that's out there right now. So Joe talked about cabotegravir, the injectable, into the butt. So it is being used for treatment, as he showed us the results. But it's also being used right now in a huge study to look at it as PrEP, being dosed as an injection every other month right now. Head-to-head comparative study, I'm going to talk about it tomorrow, but it's sponsored by the HPTN, so big NIH-sponsored study. I think it's 4,500 patients, and you get randomized either one pill once a day, Truvada, or you get injections of cabotegravir every other month. And it's head-to-head, and it's placebo-controlled. Everyone gets pills, everyone gets injections. And so that's a fully powered study that's accruing right now, and we will have an answer. Do you think your patients would like, for PrEP, an injection every other month?
No.
As opposed to a pill?
No?
No.
Got shot haters and
so he's gone like this. It depends, right?
Some of the sex workers, that may work better.
So my thought is, like birth control, we need different options for different people, right? And certain people like one and certain people like the other. And why shouldn't we have a whole array of options for people to use? Pain with the injections. I mean, it hurts, right? It's in the... So the average duration of pain for cabotegravir is 2 days. So you do... Yeah. People reported it, I think... Almost 100% of people report injection site reactions, but almost all are mild to moderate. There's very few people that ever stop that medication because of injection site reactions. So it's not like those T20 ones that we were talking about earlier where you get the lumps and they just don't go away. I had a...
Like 4 cc's, though, in the injection?
It's 3. That's a big injection. Remember, that really is like penicillin. So I suspect some people will like this and some people will prefer to take one pill a day. And remember, the great thing about PrEP is that you don't need to take it forever, right? You only need it when you need it, and when you don't, you don't. And the other thing I was going to bring up with your person with the renal issue is, might you use the PrEP on-demand model in someone like that, depending on how much sex they're having and how many pills they'll be taking? Because then you'll limit it, right? Everyone's aware of that. That's the hypergay regimen. So you take 2 Truvadas, 2 pills, 2 to 24 hours before sex, 1 24 hours after, and 1 48 hours after. And that was, in the big study, 86% effective. And the people that broke through weren't taking it. So, and then, I don't know if Joe mentioned this. Oh, I guess he did. They looked at it in low users, and people who used it much less also had that kind of protection.
It's 2 together. Correct?
Yep.
Like the 2 to 2. Okay.
Like you take
one
the two.
Provided that was real resistant. That's how he was like, okay, I'll do it. But then, like our public health got caught. Like, he's using it like the morning after pill. It was like a huge controversy in town. And like, oh my gosh.
So let's be clear. It's not FDA approved that way.
Right.
But we as physicians get to use it how we want. And that would certainly limit the number of pills you're taking, so it might be less toxic.
So I have another question about practical PrEP 2017. So one large population that I try to encourage the providers in my practice to think about are the patients that you start on NPEP. So you really should think about transitioning them to PrEP. But one problem is that the NPEP guidelines, they're still they're still not really, I think, up to date to be able to factor in the...
Everybody knows what NPEP is, non-occupational post-exposure prophylaxis.
The practical application of the fourth gen test. So this still the recommendation is to do post, you know, to do post PEP testing at 6 weeks and at 12 weeks.
Yeah,
but,
it does
you know,
say
with
that.
The fourth gen test, you should be able to have some advantages, and those advantages should be able to help you, like, transition the patient to PrEP right after they're done with their MPEP, right? Is that thinking in the right direction? So, like, theoretically, right, like 2 weeks after their exposure, while they're on their MPEP, you should be able to test them and have a pretty good degree of certainty as to whether or not they're negative. They'll still continue their NPEP for the full 28 days, and then you would transition them right to PrEP without any fear, right, of transitioning a positive person to PrEP. Is that the right thing?
So is everybody getting the subtleties here? So we're all recommending PEP for serious exposure, right, and it's three drugs according to the CDC, and typically we would use TDF, FTC, and most people would say Dolu or Raltegravir. And that's we think it's effective, right? There's not a lot of data, but there's been very few people who have, at least occupationally, that have seroconverted on those regimens. And that's an ideal person to switch to PrEP, right? Someone who needs PEP means that they had a serious exposure that actually brought them to healthcare. So it's an ideal person to go ahead and transition. And the question is, how do you know you're testing, and then how do you know you can just switch over? The last thing you want to do with PrEP, everybody's aware, is to give two drugs to someone who's seroconverting and you don't know it, right, because they will quickly develop resistance, and that's been documented. So I guess I would say, in addition to what you said, you know, you follow them according to the guidelines, test them with the fourth gen. Obviously, you're going to talk to them and see if they have any symptoms of acute infection at all. And then I would send a viral load test, too, just because that's earlier, right? The viral load test after exposure will turn positive within 10 days, and then the fourth gen will turn positive within 14 days, typically. So right next to each other, but two different methods, so it sort of gives you more confidence that they're truly negative.
And then so implicit in what you're saying is that even if you're on three drugs, if you are seroconverting, you should have some viral load?
Well, that's tricky. It's tricky.
You should have a viral load or a positive fourth gen.
You know, you're right to pin me down about this. I mean, the hope is you have neither and that you've aborted it and not had... And everything we know says that you will. If someone takes those three drugs, then yes. But as we know, not everybody follows instructions or is able to take the three. So, I don't know.
Because in our experience, the few people who've had any connection to PrEP who become positive, haven't become positive while they're on PrEP. They become positive in much the same way that you described, because they've come off of PrEP.
And they're between.
They either, you know, discontinued it on their own because they perceived their risk as not being high enough, and then they ended up in a high-risk situation.
Yep.
Or, you know, something happens where, like, it just becomes too cumbersome for them to get that refill or impossible administratively to get that refill, and they still have high risk.
Yeah, we don't have all the answers for this.
So touching on, I think what we briefly touched on in the larger session, and we've touched on here a little bit, but I don't think we've ever really dove in. I think there's a big push and a lot of discussion about U equals U, undetectable equals untransmittable. And obviously we're talking about the role of PrEP in this. We know there are a couple of good studies, including the partner study that's out there, that do show very adequate evidence, it seems to low in large cohorts, that...
Everybody know what we're talking about? U equals U, by the way?
No.
Undetectable equals
untransmittable.
So this has raised, I think, a big change. I think that if you're looking historically as the guidelines in the CDC kind of put out, first there was kind of a discussion about using PrEP in serodiscordant couples, then there was a discussion about using it in MSM, then eventually it was kind of opened up to kind of everything. So if you look at the progression kind of PrEP kind of rolling out in the United States as it was approved and different guidelines were set up, kind of serodiscordant couples are one of the first cohorts that we were really looking at.
Yeah, absolutely.
The real questions we're really asking now is that if you are undetectable and you are in a serodiscordant relationship, should we be using this? And then the question is, even though we have that kind of data, as HIV providers and PrEP providers, to what extent do we endorse a U equals U proposal or a promotion campaign or social media campaign based on the latest data we have, versus at what point do we kind of say that's true for most people, But we do, and we had a couple of good examples earlier this morning about the steroid-escorted couple with a woman that comes to you after, you know, PrEP's been out for 5 years, and I think it was you actually that said, and it was exactly what I said, is that, you know, there may be someone that she's coming to you for a reason. If she's asking
right.
for PrEP after having been with this person for 17 years and PrEP's existed in the market for 5 years, should you say no because you equals you? No, that doesn't make sense, even though we know we've got good evidence.
This is a great point. So let's go through the data just a little bit. The older data from the year 2000 that someone, I think SAG quoted it today, Tom Quinn looked at people in Africa, none of whom are receiving ART, and then just looked at how many people transmitted to their partners. And not surprising to us today, but it was New England Journal at the time, the lower the viral load, the less risk of transmission. There were no transmissions with the viral load under 1,500. But remember, the caveat there is none of them were taking ART. So these are people who just had natural low viral load. So maybe, you know, you can't extrapolate that to the world and say, oh, if you're below 1,500, you won't transmit. There may have been something unique about them. And then fast forward to
them
this.
Or their virus.
Pardon?
Them or their virus?
Sorry, what?
There may be something unique about them or something about their virus.
Oh, sorry, either one. Yeah, I didn't get your point. It could be the host, it could be the virus, or it could be the whatever the transmission act was, too.
So low, 'cause they got
it could be that. That's been documented, actually, over history. But it could also, anyway, it's multifactorial. You can't figure it out. And then the study that you mentioned, the partners study. So this was in Europe. It was a bunch of countries in Europe. And they recruited people who were in a discordant relationship, one pos, one neg. The positive person was on treatment, undetectable, and the negative person was in a committed relationship with them, and they didn't use condoms and were ready to tell everybody that. Okay? They recruited heterosexual, homosexual couples, and they followed them along. And in that study with hundreds of couples, they showed zero transmissions. That's all great, right? It supports this idea if you're undetectable, you can't transmit. What's the caveat here? It's who were these people, right? So they are in a committed couple, and they have made the decision not to use condoms, and they're ready to tell you that. So, again, it's great that there were no transmissions, but are these couples, can you really extrapolate to the world? Can you extrapolate from that study to someone who meets someone for the first time and they say, I'm undetectable, and they say, okay, we don't have to use condoms? Probably not, right? Because those couples were in a committed relationship. They had had sex without condoms for a while before they came forward, and then, okay, so none of them seroconverted.
Are there ulcers? Is there a concomitant syphilis? Is there other things we're talking about?
There's lots of other stuff. And then there's the newest study is called the Opposites Attract Study. Have you heard? What a great name. And it's MSM in a serodiscordant couple as well. They didn't restrict to people that were undetectable in the positive partner, but something like 80% of the positive men were. And they didn't restrict who, if you could be on PrEP or not, but only like 20% ever took PrEP. And then they looked at all the different sex acts and combinations and blah, 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 blah. At the end, how many seroconversions on that study? Zero. So it's building. I would agree with you. And I think Jeannie Marazzo said today, the CDC is not ready to say U equals U yet. But there is kind of the swell of data that's really suggesting that it U equals U, or it's very, very low risk, so low that we shouldn't worry.
What about like, I think you may have been alluding to this earlier, but, you know, if you've got some couple coming in there, you know, how forthcoming are they going to be when they're both sitting there?
I would never see them together, right?
You can't do that.
No, you got to see them separately.
You know, I mean, wasn't there also a study that showed some seroconversions did occur, and then when they pinned them down, it was with a different strain. They were stepping outside.
Not even pinning them down, right? They just did genetic mapping.
Yeah, they showed
this is not your partner's virus.
Yeah.
So they've done that in several studies.
If they are no detect and the partner asks for PrEP, I think you may be preventing a divorce if you give them PrEP. It's just like, you know, if you deny the birth control pill to the lady whose husband's had a vasectomy, you know, then
setting him up for a situation here.
Yeah, that's.
Well, I mean, there were five conversions, and these couples that were supposed to be,
So we all realize human behavior says people do have sex outside their committed relationships.
Well,
we're all aware of that.
Before we get on, you don't agree with that? Well, yeah, I mean, before we start, saying people are just, we've got all this, these people outside of relationships, I keep making the point, and I've made it also to our people in the state, that undetectable and someone that's newly diagnosed and may only had undetectable viral load, you know, for the past two times is different from someone that's been on medication, diagnosed for years,
sure.
and undetectable for years. And I think there's a difference between the two. We're trying to lump everybody into one, and it's not necessarily the case. And I also explain to my patients the difference between viral load and semen, viral load and other parts of your body that
sure.
we may not pick up with these tests. So I'm also asking our people at the state level to, when you say U equals U, to make sure that we're not, there's a difference between who's recently undetectable and who's been stable and undetectable.
It's a really good point. U equals U, but there should be an asterisk next to the U with some exceptions. Yes. Right, you just don't know.
Because the data was retrospective or close to real time, right, for the studies, and it's not the same as what we see every day in a clinic.
Yeah, you're right about that. But obviously when you're counseling a couple, you will have a feel for the positive partner and how undetectable they are and how much they take their meds. And, you know, a lot of people really are always undetectable if you can get that history. But I agree with both of you to say you can't generalize to the world and say, undetectable.
I guess that was my point. I understand the studies. I've looked at the studies, and I know the data for each of those. And I think we all realize that U equals almost U. The question is, when does from a public health campaign perspective, right, when you're putting out subways, I'm not sure if Demetrius is going to be doing this soon or not or whatever. I mean,
that's our commissioner of health.
Right. So if we're going to be putting out any major health campaigns or whatever, at what point do we decide that U equals close enough to U that it's good enough for a public health campaign? And I think this is where I'm stuck. I know the data, but my question is when do you step over that line? When is undetectable?
This is a challenge to all of us, right, because it's complicated. There's a number of caveats. You have to understand really complicated data, and what do we want out of it? We want a slogan, right, U equals U. Yeah, oh, wow, lots of hands. Yep.
In terms of the asterisks, I recall one study, transmission undetectable, a case report for the genetically mapped part of that. I mean, are there any, outside of these studies, are there any case reports where the virus has been genetically mapped?
That's really interesting. Does anybody know that? I haven't seen anyone look. I mean, it would be almost impossible to do that, right? How would you be following a couple so closely that you would have that data to show that one transmitted to the other when they were undetectable?
So,
be tough.
So no one else remembers a case report.
Anybody ever seen a case like that in the literature or anything?
Mm-hmm. It would be banks of frozen samples you could take retrospectively and look at.
Be tough, though. You'd have to be in the right moment at the right time. That would be a tough one. Interesting. Yep.
I just had a comment. When this whole thing of U equals U came up, I had a patient that came up, and he was definitely not in a committed relationship because he had told me that. And he insisted that he was serially dating people that were undetectable.
Yeah.
So he didn't want to consider PrEP. So I said, you have more than one, two, three partners, and you're sure they're undetectable. Yeah. So I don't need. And I went to this conference, and the guy said you're from the front. And then I went back to social media, and anybody that had a question about that, and I'm talking about highly scientific people, friends of mine, it almost was like, oh, you're basically discriminating because you're suggesting that people may still pass the virus, that get back to the 21st century. And refreshing that I'm not hearing that here because that's what I've been raising.
Oh, you thought you missed the boat on it.
Yeah, I said I may have missed the boat maybe because anything that you say absolute in medicine, I mean, you know, you have to be very careful because this human behavior. So when I try to tell that to the hands, well, I just feel that you're trying to push PrEP on me. And after he was the one that asked me the question, he just wanted to know, I want you to tell me absolutely, are you sure that I need... And I'm sitting there like, I don't even know where my kids are right now. So
That was great. So people are making choices about partners, right? We call it zero sorting back not too long ago, where you would negatives would pick negatives and positives. But a lot of it, of course, is relying on a person that you may not know very well or you just met. And then to take it one step further to undetectable, I mean, it's admirable that that person knows enough to say, oh, I'm only going to have sex with undetectable people. But then how do you ensure that they're truly undetectable? Yeah, well, and people do that, I guess. In the apps, you can say on prep and you can say undetectable.
Even one that I've been encouraging people to look on the portal and show before you hook up with someone, if you meet someone on Grindr or whatever, look on the portal and you show your portal access to them. And it shows your HIV test and they show yours.
Oh, wow.
You show yours and I'll show you mine. Say,
but then, of course, there's a date on that test, right? We've had that before. People will carry around their test results with them and show, and you say, well, do you have one from today? Yes.
I think the you versus you, I think for a public health campaign, it is a very slippery slope. And I think as a provider, though, I'm not comfortable treating the person sitting in front of me based on the behavior of the person who's not in the room. So if they're a negative person,
it's well said.
You know, it's like if that person, not just if they're having another relationship, but if they stop taking their meds, and you don't know, and we haven't done what we can do to protect you, that's what I'm not comfortable with, is just basing their health on the behavior of another person. And that's kind of the conversation that I have around.
And that's the beauty of PrEP, right? Because you take it yourself. You don't have to rely on someone else. They don't have to know if you're taking it or not. And you don't get resistant to it. There's a lot of good stuff.
So, Tripp, I wanted to make sure that the hour didn't end with before folks realize that, that cost should not be an obstacle to putting a lot of people on PrEP, not everybody, but a lot of people, because through the manufacturer website, through Gilead, you could really get a lot of people on PrEP for next to nothing. And the irony is that like patients who have Medicaid or Medicare are usually not able to get that help. So if you're in the South, where Medicaid expansion didn't happen in a lot of states, you can still actually get PrEP for your patients who might have been Medicaid eligible had there been expansion, but don't have it.
Have people heard stories about people problems getting PrEP because of insurance? Did everyone hear about what happened with United Healthcare?
Yes, they were required prior
off. This was awesome. They denied someone because they were high risk and homosexual, that they couldn't get PrEP. And the activists got wind of this, fought it right to the top, and they changed their policy and came out with an apology to the community. How often does that happen?
So for some of the privatized insurance, like the cost of shield, some policies, they just want to know, is the person taking it for PrEP? And that's a big one. Most of our work in the health department in Jacksonville, Florida, so a lot of the folks that are receiving PrEP is through the patient system or the patient system.
And that's a phone call.
The phone call I always get, right? Yes. You know this is an HIV med, so they take it for PrEP, or you are so stupid that you're giving... I think that when pharmacists come, they say, fine, it's for PrEP.
Well, just not the sidebar to Medicaid, by the way, every year they want us to say, why is the person on these HIV medications giving them to them? So just as a sidebar.
Exactly.
My question is, who's going to, if we do see the injectable or we see Truvada going generic, my concern is how...
So tenofovir is going generic. Supposedly, it won't actually be available generically in our country till like 2020 or something like that. The co-form may be longer, so it might be two generic pills. It's in the future, for sure.
I have two questions. One, you can get the meds from Gilead. Who's paying the co-pays for the follow-up visits and the labs?
Gilead will not do that. But there are grants. There are grants that you can apply for that can cover, like, all of the patient's care as far as all the types of a patient's care. And there are foundations that administer those grants. And, you know, they may have the money at the beginning of the year, and they may not have the money, you know, by the middle of the year. But that's another option.
Of course, screening for STDs is a valid thing.
One other question. The whole data was new. Yes. There's always the data that showed if the person knows their HIV status, they tend to be in control and doing the right things. Is that one of the reasons they're looking at, if more people know that they won't transmit, they may get tested and find their HIV status? I don't know what the thinking is.
What you said is true. People who know they're positive tend to participate in behaviors less often to spread than people that don't know they're positive. That is a fact.
You may stimulate more folks to get tested and find your status.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, you would hope that's true. If people hear, oh, wow, if I'm positive and I'm on meds and I'm undetectable. That you mean that testing rates are increasing because of the U equals U? I don't think so. But testing rates are pretty good right now in the U.S. altogether. Kristen?
So I'm interested in sort of identifying those characteristics that would help us to link the right individuals to PrEP. So we've heard some things, like the person who was on MPEP, ensuring that they go on.
Yep.
So in Connecticut, I worked on a project for people who had syphilis reported to the Department of Public Health, having those EIS workers who are going out and doing contact tracing and following up, making sure that at least PrEP education and a possible referral was linked.
Yep.
And we had resistance from our EIS workers, so it didn't go as far as I would have liked, but at least in our clinical setting, anyone who has syphilis is then referred for PrEP.
I think that's a good one. And the CDC guidelines go further and say new bacterial sexually transmitted infection. So we talked about people that use PEP, NPEP. We talked about commercial sex workers, recent STI.
IV drug users
who are sharing their works or needles. Members of serodiscordant couples, again, with an asterisk, depending.
Yeah, I mean, I think anybody with a rectal or a cervical infection is another person who, like, clearly comes into your practice regularly and you can consider having that
preference.
Yep.
How often do you actually get histories of HIV positive, syphilis positive, vindictive people who are out to get anybody they can get?
Yeah, I mean, you've heard those stories since the beginning of the epidemic, that there are people with mental health issues who are out there with revenge or stuff. I think they're usually talked a lot more about than they merit. I think it's very rare that you actually hear about that. Would anyone argue with that?
No, I agree with you.
One thing I have is a lot of young people between 16 to 24 that become newly diagnosed, you give them a story that you got to monitor your habits. And for about 6 months, they may do that. They take medicines, and then they get lost to follow-up. And the next thing you know, that they're out there with this group of people, and this young group of people just having casual sex with everybody.
Adolescents, definitely tough given everything else going on with their world, and then having to take care of a chronic illness and take medication, that's really tough.
So even though they don't have this vindictive attitude, they are weapons.
This is a reason why PrEP needs to target that population, right? Protect the other people in the community from being exposed.
I think some of this is normal. I mean, I'm in adolescent medicine, so when we
Perfect.
Say adolescent...
Glad you're here.
I
Did you say weapons?
Well, that's what I thought I heard, like, when they're... Like,
I mean,
he's
a weapon.
Yeah, that just makes me cringe, because I think some of this is brain development, right? Adolescents
Absolutely.
Cannot understand the risks and benefits of those decisions. And really, our brains don't mature until we're 25. The rental car companies have it right. So I think, like, the thing that people are out there purposely doing this, when I really think so much of this is really trying to figure out who am I. Right? Like,
I think that was the point. Not so much vindictive, but just being...
Vindictive. They were just out there casually having sex. You lost this follow-up about 6 months, and you out there
want to be just a part of every other group, but you're not. You are carrying something that is everything.
And that's why PrEP can be helpful.
Right. So going back to the point of, you know, who else should we screen and
about
PrEP. So in my practice, I practice at Community Health Center in Boston, and I've started asking because of what I've heard from my patients, number one, what is the age of the partner? Because I've had a young man, you know, MSM, who is 21, newly into coming into being MSM, and I put him on PrEP because he was having multiple partners, and he came back to his follow-up at 3 months, and he said he stopped, and I said, well, why? He said, well, I got into a relationship with this older partner, and he doesn't trust me because I'm on PrEP. It pained me because what I could sense from it was just a sense of powerlessness. He didn't feel powerful enough in that interaction to say, hey, it's not about you, it's just about me. So I've started to ask about the age of their partners as part of the screening. And a second is when I did a presentation in the community, this woman raised her hand and said, my daughter's going off to college, should I put her on PrEP? You know, I don't even know how to answer her. Of course, if she knows her daughter and maybe has a sense of, you know, how active her daughter may be. So it's something that should also think about in students who are going to college. You know, my patients is starting to say, should I specifically start having more questions?
So the CDC helps us a little bit, right? They say MSM. It's expected that the community will have a prevalence that's high enough to merit that a person should go on it. For heterosexuals, there's another asterisk, and it says if the community that they're having sex in has a high enough prevalence rate. Of course, that's not the kind of thing many of us know, right? Like, what is the seroprevalence? And, of course, it doesn't matter really what's going on in the community. It matters who you're sleeping with. Are they positive or not, and what's the chance of that? So it's a little tougher, I would say. Yep, I'll take a couple more, then we're going to stop.
I was just going to say, on top of adolescent medicine and just like the younger population, are you guys finding a lot of like resistance as far as like you're telling them about PrEP? And I just feel like a lot of these kids are like, why would I even need that? Like, they just don't understand like the risk, and you can educate them, but they just seem to be like, oh, like I'll never get it, or I don't do kids with HIV. And they just are really naive to it or just don't believe that they could get it.
Educational moments.
Yeah.
Like, particularly for MSM.
We're starting to understand it now as far as like adolescents, because I feel like in my clinic, I just, no matter how many times I tell them, or even like all my patients are positive, and getting them to be consistent with their meds, no matter how many times I tell them that they can transmit this, if they aren't controlling their virus, they just like don't seem to be.
It's tough.
It varies.
Yeah.
Yep.
I think it's really interesting in our times that, you know, it's we have a lot more sexual fluidity, and it's very acceptable. So it's answered the issue of going on PrEP, and you know, it's really a long conversation and really talking to, you know, bringing that person in and, you know, talking to them about that and really navigating that. It's very.
And I go back to the thing that PrEP is not forever. So there may be a period of time when you need it, even in college, maybe. Then there's a period of time you won't need it.
I just had a question about that PrEP is not forever comment, because it came up in Colorado recently. I actually work for the state health department, so it's really interesting for me. And waiting for FMP licensure, so I didn't raise my hand. But we had put onto an educational material, PrEP is not forever. And some people came back and asked, well, what if I'm at risk forever? I'm a gay man, I'm single, blah, blah, blah. I'm not going to change. You know, I don't have a desire to be monogamous. I want to be single and I want to have multiple partners. So I might be at risk forever as far as I'm sexually functional. So how do you respond? Like, that's the question, this whole seasons of risk concept that's kind of coming around.
Yeah.
The attention piece.
You're good to call me on it. You know, it's just like we said before. It's like everything is more subtle than a slogan, right? I think for many people, PrEP will be for certain periods in their lives, and there will be some people who may need it forever, for the rest of their lives. Whoever needs it, and we should be helping them get it, I think.
I just have a quick
general question. When if someone comes in for PrEP, are you giving it the same day, or are you waiting? I mean, I know we have to get the test that shows they're HIV negative, but for things like hepatitis B and their renal function, or we've actually seen people we screen who have pretty high liver enzyme abnormalities, and yet we're still getting this push, like, I have to walk out of there with the same day with a prescription, as opposed to waiting a day or two getting the results back.
You know what many people will do is give the prescription and then say, don't start till I call you to tell you that your tests are okay. Because, again, the last thing you want to do is give it to someone who's seroconverting.
Correct, yeah.
So that can work. I don't know if other people have different strategies for that.
I would just say, so Colorado's STD clinic is funded by Gilead to do a same-day start research project. So patients that come in with positive STDs come out with a 30-day starter pack of drug from the company, and then they get into a more long-term solution. So I think more data around that's coming. That study is almost completely full. I think they'll have 150 people that are kind of looking at that.
But use the phone call thing, I think, will work. Say, we got to make sure that you don't have HIV infection. Wait to hear from me before you start. I think that's the right way to do it. Last comment, and then we got to stop.
A question. How do you manage those patients who come in who have had their last unprotected intercourse after? It's been more than 72 hours, but not 2 weeks.
Right. That's a tricky one. So, you got to let them know that they are at risk. So you want to probably delay a week and just say, look, the last thing I want to do is start this if you happen to get HIV in that encounter. So do the testing, but just make sure the window is okay. We're fortunate to have, you know, viral load becoming positive within 10 days and the fourth generation within 2 weeks. So
do DNA?
There's not really a reason to do the DNA. So no, it doesn't tell you more than those RNA tests that are the first test to become positive. All right, well, thanks for joining me.